these huge giants, you know, walking amidst the clouds or what have you.
Oh, this compels me.
Metal music. It's hard to write a song in an entire minor key and talk about, you know, nice things. Heavier, obviously, doomier at times.
When he came over, and God, when he started singing, bloody hell. I couldn't believe what's coming out of his little body.
Somebody said, anyone got an idea what we should do as a stage set? Jesus said, Stonehenge. So there's this dwarf comes out, and he's walking across the top of the Stonehenge. Pure spanker.
Black Shadow!
If you listen to Fools, you listen to me. How are you doing, Supernauts? Welcome to Sabbath Bloody Podcast, a sabography for the masses. We're episode 10 here. We're throwing up the big X and the Roman numerals. And I hope you're all enjoying the trip here so far into Dio Sabbath. Yes, I certainly am. The Heaven and Hell episode I did a couple weeks ago, I got some solid feedback on the socials. Big spike, actually, in the legit interaction with the show. There are a lot of people out there who really love this era and want to wise me up to some stuff and, you know, just throw up the horns for Ronnie James Dio. And I get it. I love you for it. Cilantro. It's a different beast, but it's a damn good one. And honestly, the Aussie stuff, even though that's what I love truly and probably always will, it has been done to death with like fanboys, myself included. I mean, I did just spend the better part of a year digging into just those albums, but that Sabs 4, that original Ozzy, Tony, Geezer, Bill, it's been like curated so much in their official feed, even like, fuck it, it was the Sabs 3 for a bit, right? So they were even knocking Bill Ward out of the picture for a while there, but they're actually doing better to rectify that, at least lately, but still. It's always about the 70s. They never touch on any of this stuff. There's plenty of other podcasts out there, too, touching on the classic Sabbath albums. The first six, eight if you're lucky, are often on those metal podcasts that are out there. But this is what I really started this podcast for. It's to discover this other stuff that hasn't hit my radar yet, you know? And to interact with the fans who love it and find out if I love it. And I do. I can tell you already, one album in, and I'm fucking in. Dio is awesome. The stuff they're doing, terrific. And sadly, this is the last of the 80s Dio albums here that we'll be covering. And this one today is a monster, lads. Excited to cover today, and not to cheat or look ahead too much, but I'm very much looking forward to all the Dio Sabbath down the line. And even those Deep Purple guys who come in, I'm looking forward to dissecting that. The Tony Martin guy with the receding hairline there, whatever his deal is, I'm excited to find it. I'll let all the Sabbath into my gumbo here. And, you know, thanks for joining me, guys. That's all I got to say. This is a fan podcast. Just remember that. Because there are some people who just, like, tear into me and say, oh, he's a hack, whatever. Like, I'm just, this is my fan journey, okay? So, you're in or you're out. But as for Dio Sabbath, look out! I'm in. It might be a hot take, but when I really stack up these two albums even, there isn't a weak track on Mob Rules. But Heaven and Hell, it had a couple of like missteps, some growing pains, I guess. More of a transition album. I mean, it was a transition album, so, you know, tracks like Walk Away, The Wishing Well, they were okay, but nothing stands out as just okay on this record. Mob Rules is killer stuff all the way through. And stuff is amped up. The atmosphere is pushed to incredible levels. So let's get into it here. Get into some history first, as we do in this sabography. We already kind of made the transition at the end of the Heaven and Hell episode, actually. Setting up this lineup here and the concept that they were going to go in for their sophomore offering. We now have Vinny Appice behind the kit. And the boys did do a one-off track with him for the heavy metal animated film. And a big push that happened there with Sandy Pearlman, their manager at the time, to be kind of paired with like Blue Oyster Cult and all that stuff. I didn't touch on this last time, but I've been getting into BOC more here just through this Dio Sabbath exploration. There's all kinds of links to Sabbath. And there were articles that like compared the two, like the BOC was the American version of Sabbath. And, you know, it's clearly Sandy is pitching them as a pairing and, you know, getting them out there. But I love Blue Oyster Cult, some killer albums here. And you got the Black and Blue Tour, the obvious connection there, but also Blue Oyster Cult is on that heavy metal soundtrack with them. And even the album cover itself for Heaven and Hell, you know, like the Smoke and Angels. Well, that was the same artist who BOC used previously on their, I guess you could call it their big album, Agents of Fortune, the one that had Don't Fear the Reaper on it. And Martin Birch, he was BOC's guy for the last couple albums that they're doing, the Cultosaurus Erectus. So let's give it up for Sandy Pearlman here with this fantastic push that he did for both these guys. A cool pairing. So Solancha to Mr. Sandy Pearlman, who unfortunately will be leaving us quite soon here in this process, heading into Mob Rules. So I mentioned those two tracks for the heavy metal soundtrack gig. They were cut in John Lennon's old gaff, the all-white room that he had there. And the song called The Mob Rules became the catalyst for them to keep building off of that theme directly. And they go in to record an album called Mob Rules. They dropped the. But Tony really liked the vibes of those recordings from that white room, as do I. I think they're great cuts. I played it at the end of last episode. But apparently he was pushing for them to just rent that out for a couple of months and record and conceive the whole album in that vibe. Martin Birch, however, he wasn't so hot on the mix that they got there and said sonically, you know, they could do better. And here, I can actually bring up some text to support this claim here. And this talks about the initial entry into the studio for this Mob Rules material that they've been working on. We might as well start here, right? From the book, My Journey Through Heaven and Hell, Tony Iommi, Iron Man. We wanted to use the John Lennon room for our new album as well, but our producer, Martin Birch, said, oh no, it won't match up sound-wise. So we ended up re-recording it. As a matter of fact, we re-recorded it twice. So I think he's talking specifically about the Mob Rules track here, not the full album. I should make that clear. But we re-recorded it twice because first, we had another great scheme of ours go wrong. Martin said, you know how much it costs to do an album? Why don't you buy your own studio? Because we could be in there for like 2 months or 3 months or whatever without worrying about the cost of it all. It was a great idea. We sent Martin over to LA to have a look at a studio he'd found to see what it was like. He said, it's good, it just needs a new desk. So we bought it and a bloody $250,000 sound desk, put it in, put the tape machines in, and off we went to go and record in it. It was crap. We just couldn't get a guitar sound. We tried in the studio, we tried it in the hallway, we tried it everywhere, but it just wasn't happening. We bought a studio and it wasn't working. We re-recorded a new version of the Mob Rules, but abandoned it. We finally just walked out and went to the record plant where we had to pay again, so it cost us twice as much. And so there you go. Keep in mind this was the 80s too, so no home studios built into your goddamn iPad. The whole process would have put these boys back quite a bit. And I think that whole ordeal might have been the catalyst to them ultimately ditching Sandy Pearlman and bringing back some of that mob money. Yeah, we'll get to that soon. But, you know, this also establishes that the boys were still kind of rocking the cocaine hard at any opportunity. As I read on here, even Martin Birch, as Tony alludes to him getting a little snowblind in the recording process. But this quote here. We wrote the rest of the songs for the Mob Rules album when we were in LA. We got a rehearsal room in the valley somewhere where we tried stuff, got ideas that we'd tape and take back to the house. I rented a place in Toluca Lake. After the rehearsals with the band, me and Jeff Nichols used to come back there, do a little bit of coke, and work on some of the ideas. We put new bits in, change stuff up, add to it, try a few other ideas, and then the next day, all of us got back together in the rehearsal room and tried it again. So there you go. clearly showing that this is the Iommi and Jeff Nichols operation as far as like conceiving the compositions that are on here. I think they tried to recreate the process that they did on Heaven and Hell, where they fleshed it out and then showed it to Dio and Geezer, had them lay their parts in. And you could start to see, like, Iommi's kind of reasserting himself more going into the Mob Rules cycle here. For one thing, the lads switched management, as I've alluded to. They were back to, can you guess it? Yes, Big Bad Don Arden comes back into the fold as they record the Mob Rules material. I guess he got over the whole Dio is a midget and his hang-up that he had with, you know, that stuff when he realized how incredibly badass Black Sabbath is with Dio. So Sandy Pearlman is let go, or maybe he left. Haven't followed his thread really, but despite the cool tour and the soundtrack spots he arranged and that pairing with Blue Oyster Cult, it was clear Arden had the big money and he could, you know, get them into those LA studios, get the tour jacked up a little bit. It's hilarious how trapped Sabbath becomes by their goddamn management. Like, I guess it all works out for them as far as getting the albums and tours going, but it's always like Don was there and he dropped them, but now he's back. And then it's Patrick Meehan for a little bit, and then he steals a bunch of money and they boot him and they get Don back to fight the court cases. It's like, fuck. I mean, it's well documented that Don's interest in holding Black Sabbath as an asset in the early 80s, it's mostly rooted in a big kind of blow up that he had with his daughter, Sharon Arden, now by this point leading towards becoming Sharon Osbourne. She took off with Ozzy by 1981, I think they get married, or 82, around this time anyway. There's a huge back and forth rally of shit flinging too that begins here, where Don basically takes Tony Iommi as his asset and kind of wrangle Sharon and Ozzy, or crush them, or attempt to crush them. We'll get into it deep today, no doubt. Like, I have my theories on this Don Arden feud here. For starters, anyway, Don steps in with the big money again to get the Mob Rules recorded and everything happening. I haven't been able to find much on the writing process of the Mob Rules tracks after, you know, those Iommi quotes that I had earlier there about him and Nichols getting blasted in the Toluca Valley. So there's a little bit of a gap, unfortunately, as far as what songs were done first. I mean, we know Mob Rules was done ahead of time for the soundtrack, but I assume a lot of this material was conceived, or ideas of it, on the road. You know, some previous riffs that Iommi had. But we gotta say, there's some tremendous compositions on this record. Like, this is not just a bunch of rejects from the Heaven and Hell material. Mob Rules has, like, I don't know, just a little more punch, a little more live off the floor feel, a little more loose in places, but then also, like, the atmosphere just amps up. It's like a great example. You look at, like, Children of the Sea, which is like 10 out of 10, fucking epic. And you think, yeah, there's no way you can improve that. And then you hear Sign of the Southern Cross, and you're like, wait a minute, this is like Children of the Sea, but it's better. Is it better? It's not a dip going to Mob Rules. They take everything that they did on Heaven and Hell and just improve it, I think.
Power of the riff compels me.
Won't you listen?
There's our good friend Ben ripping into it today. Shit ton of high energy off the top of Mob Rules. Some bouncy major keyed metal for you. Turn up the night! There's a little looser tone throughout the riff here. It just jangles more, you know? It's a great, quick opener. No complaints. And the way they sink into the next vibey one, Voodoo. Burn down that track, actually, because unfortunately I don't have a riff bank for this one. It's one of the few that Ben hasn't covered, but it's Voodoo, and that baby fucking struts. A great second track, and Vinnie Appice just crushes the drums on this entire album. So good. I know some people get on Vinnie for being too straight ahead with his beats, but his fills and transitions are super rad. It isn't flashy, but goddamn, he can fucking drive a song. And the lyrics, too, are some of Ronnie's most evil here. Bring me your children, they'll burn. Like, fucking No coded bullshit here. Look out, PMRC. Flag this one. Just some swampy, evil blues about the devil, yeah? And I'll agree that there are some great songs on Heaven and Hell, and it's structured well. But you can tell that they wrote the songs over several years there. They were perfectionists about it. And there's no loose, vibey shit like there is on Mob Rules. None of that voodoo magic, you know? Apart from Lonely is the Word, maybe. But even the guts of this LP, tracks like Slippin' Away, Country Girl, they might not be Dio Sabbath classics in the minds of many, but goddamn, do they have some fucking swagger. And it sounds like a band, a confident and relaxed band, just fucking doing what they do. Tony tries new things too, lead-wise. And from Voodoo, they go into fucking Sign of the Southern Cross. God damn, I can't even do justice to this song in words. I think it's like they took everything that was good about Children of the Sea and Lonely is the Word, and they just sunk it together perfectly and made their epic. The epic of all epics. Sign of the Southern Cross. After Sign, to end the A-side, it's their contribution to the heavy metal animated film a year earlier. First of all, you get E5150, a soundscape, an instrumental interlude, mostly keyboards, so I don't have anything to play for you, but starting here, the interludes become less guitar parts, like they were on Embryo and Laguna and Fluff. Those great Iommi interludes kind of sink away at the beginning of the 80s because it's more keyboard-driven, kind of atmospheric, bits that they come in. They carry this through pretty much all of the 80s albums. But E5150 is kind of a prototype for cuts like Stonehenge, The Dark, even Guardian off of Seventh Star. Just a little chance for Jeff Nichols to fuck around some, I guess. But the song title, if you haven't deciphered the Zodiac there yet, E5150. So it's E, then the Roman numeral for 5, which is V. Then 1 is I. Then, of course, the Roman numeral for 50 is L. So E-V-I-L. Evil, evil! Yeah, very coded shit from the boys there. So I should stop calling it E-5150. I should be calling it E-5150 to be completely correct. I just default to Van Hagar 5150, right? Anyway, it doesn't matter. It sets up the barn burner from the album, which is the fucking title track. Fucking amazing title track, too. I've already mentioned how much I dig this song. The energy on it is just great. And that Ronnie, come on. That's like my favorite fucking yell of all metal.
The power of the riff compels me.
With all the pull-off, hammer-on action, big southern kind of flavor. And the way the vocals fall over the chorus, too, it's not your traditional verse to chorus. The riff is more of the hook than the chorus, even. Just a really cool flow throughout the song. If you listen to Fools, throw the Satan. Shit, I almost knocked over my beer here. This is like Beavis and Butthead, Power of the Riff today. So for Mob Rules, it goes on to a strutter of a song. Two strutters, actually. First, you get Country Girl. There's some riffing. Underrated song to kick off the B-side, too. That riff was a contender today for fucking Power of the Riff. I'll tell you what. Good old Country Girl. Yeehaw! Sorry. And this song gets a little bit of slack from the boys themselves for some reason. I know Geezer can't stand it. They wanted to bring it into the set for the Heaven and Hell reunions, like, permanently, but Geezer shut it down, apparently, saying that the song's not Sabbath enough. I think it was just the title that throws people off on this one. But it fucking is a juggernaut of a riff, right? And Country Girl shows Dio's range again. I love how melodic he gets in there. Just a solid song, a great mid-album jam. The next one too. Love the Bonzo vibes that fucking Vinny Appice brings on this one. But Get the Lead Out, Slipping Away. Yeah, this one gets slammed too for being a straight Zeppelin ripoff. Greta Van Fleet style for my younger listeners. It does sound like something off of Presence, doesn't it? Like Before Your Life, that bluesy kind of cool stops in the riff. But it's not a ripoff. Hell, fucking Zeppelin ripped off the whole Delta blues scene, Robert Johnson and all that shit. So it's fair game for Sabbath to do a fucking hard blues rock song. I love it though. I mean, if this is in that filler spot, second track on the B-side is usually a filler spot, then this is a goddamn solid album, folks. There's all kinds of cool flavors in this one, just creating that slight delay behind the riff with the drums. When the drums are in there, I guess Tony gets credit for this vibe too, but to me it sounds like Vinny Appice is kind of setting the tone, giving this killer fucking, like I said, Bonzo flavor shuffle. And there's a killer back and forth jam too, like bass and guitar trading licks, and you gotta love that. Sabbath never really did that before, but I love it on this song. And yeah, the mid-album magic, it just keeps going. I think it really tees up the journey we go on for the final two tracks here. I guess I'll just get into them. Let's just roll out the closing numbers here. An epic pairing. First, you get Falling Off the Edge of the World. This one's amazing. What's not epic in the Dio era, but there truly are. They're epics. Epic, epic. I keep saying that. Epic, epic. You can't not sound like a hipster and say epic every 2 minutes when you're talking about Dio. But these big, long tracks are just so fucking fresh here on Mob Rules 2. There's so much in them. All four members play to their strengths, remaining true to the Sabbath sound in a way, because it's kind of doomy and plodding, but still showing a willingness to kind of progress farther. Sometimes bands do big long numbers as fillers on albums, but I find that's when they shine, these big journey songs. They earn that 7 minute plus runtime. Now, my only beef with this record really is that I would have wanted Falling Off the Edge of the World to be the actual closer on the album, because it gives me a nice wrap-up feeling. That being said, the next one, the actual closer, it fucking works too. So essentially, they have two perfect closers, and that's my gripe with the album. I love both the songs at the end. Fuck that album. And as I hinted at, Over and Over has some of the greatest Tony Iommi lead work of any song. Very vibey, takes us into the end of the record, just ripping the whole time. Oh shit, the end of 80s Dio Sabbath, actually, because that big closer, Over and Over, it's a somber track to end with, but fittingly, it just goes into that big, saucy solo at the end. Shit, what a record. Not much more to say.
Far the riff compels me.
All right, now!
Okay, so let's jump onto that lovely caravan here, and let's see what Don Arden was able to set the boys up with for the Mob Rules World Tour, 1981-1982.
It is a funny story. I think those stories are kind of best in the caravan.
So let's start things here in the summer of 81. There's an interesting gig here, actually. Right around the time they would have been, like, wrapping up or starting to record Mob Rules. This is in August of 1981, to be specific. They were offered a big outdoor gig in the UK, a horrendously titled event called the Heavy Metal Holocaust. This is like a festival kind of deal. And yes, that was the gig's name. We've gone full metal here by the early 80s. It was like a thing, as opposed to like something that reviewers would use as a negative connotation, like calling something sounds like heavy metal trash or whatever. And like, that's what the idea of heavy metal come from. But by this point, it had its own kind of culture around it, and Sabbath were at the forefront of all that. So originally, Black Sabbath were supposed to be co-headlining this festival with the Mighty Motorhead, who've also kind of bridged the gap between the hardcore punk, or not hardcore punk, at that time it would have just been called punk, but the punk and rock meld there. They're just as influential as Sabbath as far as like being, you know, inspiring the next generation of thrash and all that stuff. But anyway, Sabbath pulled out in early July due to recording commitments is what they said, which I assume has to do with finishing up the Mob Rules. So that combined with a whole bunch of, you know, building a new studio and ditching that whole debacle, it at least kind of shows us that there were some struggles that they were going through at the time, that they blow off a gig like this. So they blow it off, this potentially huge gig here. And guess who's waiting in the wings to fill that vacant spot alongside Lemmy? Well, who's always ready to pounce? Sharon! Sharon Osbourne! The Arden feud escalates here as Sharon books her man, her now husband, and that classic Blizzard of Oz lineup at that time, I think it was. I think Randy was still with us. Yeah, well, I mean, he was in 81. And they would have been just gearing up for Diary of a Madman at that time, so they might have still been working on that album, actually. But ever the opportunist, Sharon snags the spot straight from Sabbath. And just for fun, let's pull up the Ozman set list here from the Heavy Metal Holocaust, shall we? If anything, we can confirm whether or not Madman was a thing based on what's in here. So, okay, you get to open. You got, I Don't Know, always a great opener. Crazy Train. See, I'm a big Ozzy fan, so I love all these songs. Believer. So there you go right there. We get a diary track. Might have been an early version of it. But after Believer, there's Mr. Crowley. And then Flying High again, more Madman. So they must have had the album in the can at this point. It wasn't released, but you know, it was ready. Then you got Revolution, Mother Earth, badass. Steal Away the Night, I like that track. Suicide Solution. But then after that, the cheeky bastards, they get into some Sabbath cuts here to close. They play Iron Man, Children of the Grave, and Paranoid, but back to back. And yeah. There's actually like a ton of crossovers and near encounters in the early 80s between the Sabs and their estranged frontman Ozzy. So many so that I think the Arden feud seems almost orchestrated to me. Yes, I have a Sabbath conspiracy theory. Is it all just an act? The truth is out there, friends. And as you see in his set list, Ozzy still plays the big Sabbath numbers to close. But we'll get into some real drama regarding all that in a year's time. Later on in this podcast, though. This Heavy Metal Holocaust deal, it does seem like a shot fired from Ozzy's camp to the Dio Sabbath camp. Like, you know, just a shot across the bow. Nothing too damaging. But, I mean, Sharon must have had an inside track just to know that that spot would become available so she could get in there. Or, you know, they planned the whole fucking thing. Staying with our Sabbath boys, they do emerge from the studio soon enough, and we get the Mob Rules tour. It properly kicks off in North America in November of 1981. And by all accounts, it seems to have carried on well. They're back across the pond, too. They go to the Hammersmith Odeon for 4 dates, actually starting on New Year's Eve and carrying through that week there. If you look at their stage set, too, around this time, you can clearly see when the switch happened back to Don Arden's money. For the Heaven Hell cycle, they do have some cool lights and crosses on the stage. And that would have been the stage they shared with Blue Oyster Cult. So there's like some gimmicky things. They have the two big crosses. And then I think Blue Oyster Cult had a dragon or something, if I recall. But there are, you can see the Mob Rule set that comes in. There's a little bit more lights, a little bit more smoke. And they step it up with these big, massive painted backdrops, which are amazing. I wonder if they got preserved. They probably got just ripped apart and thrown out, unfortunately, but I'd like to have that in my gaff here in Ireland. Use it to divide a room up here. Hang it in my daughter's room, maybe. A tapestry with the monks with the whips, whatever is going on that cover. So here we go. Here's some accounts from Tony's book on the Hammersmith Odeon New Year's gig. And we get a little bit of Spinal Tap-esque action here, which, you know, I love that shit, so let's read it out here. We went back home for 4 dates at the Hammersmith Odeon, starting on New Year's Eve. We used lots of pyro with fire and bombs. We had this bloke working for us who dealt with all that stuff. Before the shows, we rehearsed in London in a big room behind an Irish pub. At the time, there was a lot of IRA bombings in the city. Our pyro guy decided to test a bomb in the rehearsal room. It exploded, and everybody left the Irish pub in a panic. It was chaos, absolute chaos. One of our guys was in the pub, and he said, "I couldn't believe it. Everyone just shot out, left all their drinks and everything. Whoosh, gone." Those bombs were really loud. They must have thought, "Hell, somebody's trying to blow us up." Mad it was. We played the Hammersmith, and the same pyro guy put his bombs underneath the stage. He tested one of them, and went bang and blew a 2-foot-wide hole in the floor on my side. If I had been there, I would have been blown up. Christ, it was dangerous. The guy was becoming a liability, so at the end we told him, "You're fired." No pun intended. I really don't think... I don't know. We could get into Iommi's book, and apparently there was like a ghostwriter who had English as a second language translating all this stuff. At least that's what some of the supernauts out there have been telling me, and yeah, I'm seeing it now more and more. Sometimes it sounds like Iommi, but it sounds a little, I don't know. Whatever. So that's it for the tour stories. Nothing else to it eventful for Sabbath on the Mob Rules thing. The lineup stays the same. Iommi, Dio, Geezer, and Vinny. And they even record a few of the gigs with hopes to release a live album by the end of 1982. And that's when the real drama picks up with Ozzy here. So let's take a big old swig of the good dark stuff here. Some Guinness. And let's get back into the gossip rags, the Kerrangs, and what have you. And we'll see some of the Arden family values surface here. So Sabbath's first official live album, Live Evil, is released in 1982. And it's a very important album with a lot of drama around it too, as far as the decline here of this era. On the other side, though, of the Arden compound, I guess, just a month earlier, Ozzy released Speak of the Devil, or Talk of the Devil, depending on what side of the pond you're on, a double album, which was all Sabbath material. Now, if the gig poaching at the Heavy Metal Holocaust was a warning shot, this was the declaration of war. And some might say Speak was even rushed out to take the wind out of Sabbath, or Dio Sabbath's sales. And that's a solid theory, as they even went as far as to like have a gatefold on the album, which is a picture of Dio choking out a little person with whom he has claimed his nickname is Ronnie in some interviews, so when he was asked about it. But to support my conspiracy theory here, I do think that the whole thing was a publicity stunt, and that they used the Heavy Metal gossip rags, Kerrang in particular, to drum up some controversy, to get some buzz around this thing. I mean, the guy doing the art for the Speak of the Devil album, I can't remember what his name was, but he was a guy that was on staff at Kerrang. And I think the story goes that the re-recording of the Sabbath tracks, it benefited all the members, past and present, like the original four financially, by the sounds of it, or at least that's the claims that Ozzy made later, saying that that's the reason that they did it. But the fact that it was a double album too, that kind of lights up that he was just using it to kill off the contract with Don Arden at Jet Records, because he contractually owed them 2 more records. So doing a double live album freed him from that, and Sharon and him could relaunch their career elsewhere, which is what they did. So it is probably just as simple as that. I mean, killing off the contract, but then there are these reports that Don Arden even wanted this project to happen like way back before Heaven and Hell really was, or while Heaven and Hell was going on. And it was something that he wanted to do to get the rights of those old songs. I don't know. Message me on Twitter if you have a clear way of telling me what this drama is all about. Or if you want to just put on your tinfoil hat with me and break down this stuff thinking that, you know, it's all BS. For the sake of the podcast today, I'll just touch on a few interesting things that feed into this yarn. And you can decide for yourself if it's just a scum marketing tactic from the Ardens, or if there's legit heat in the family. Or maybe both. The truth is often somewhere in the middle. And it's out there. The truth is out there. I'm telling you, conspiracy theories, man. I got one really solid example of the back and forth from these two. And there's some little quotes here that were like combined in an article. It was a clickbait article, but I believe that most of them are from like Kerrang magazine at the time, around the spring of 1982. So right before both Speak of the Devil and Live Evil were released. But there's little quotes and they go back and forth here. Ozzy and Dio. So this is really interesting to read. I don't know the context is more. Maybe I should read the footnotes in the article, but either way, let's read through here. So Ozzy says, "Those assholes," while popping open a fresh can of Budweiser, "they," Black Sabbath, "wait 15 fucking years to do a live album, and then they do one at the exact same time as mine. On top of that, they're still using some of my songs. I can't believe that they had the balls to put out Paranoid and Iron Man on their album. Black Sabbath performing those songs without me singing is like four guys getting together today and calling themselves the Beatles. That's just rubbish. I'm bigger than Sabbath ever was." I'm bigger than Jesus. He's doing his John Lennon here. "It's rather sad that they still have to live off of the songs that are 10 years old. It's a fucking joke. They don't have any more confidence. Newer material." I'm not going to try to do it. I'm not going to try to do it, Ozzy. "It's a fucking joke that they don't have more confidence in their newer material. Yeah, I do Iron Man too. But that's my song. People demand it, that I do it. I imagine Sabbath still does it because they don't feel like their new songs hold up very well." Okay. Well, take it as it is. It's a quote that was vetted to be from Ozzy, but who knows who wrote it. This is all in the actual magazines, not taken transcript from a, you know, existing video that we can prove how this came. Well, anyway, we get into Dio's side too. A direct response as he's questioned about Ozzy's comments. Dio says, "I can assure you that we didn't call up Ozzy's record label and then plot some evil scheme to steal some of his thunder. That would have been very stupid of us as well as for him. I'm not naive enough to think that a lot of our fans don't like Ozzy too. I don't think we're in direct competition. They'll just have to buy two great live albums. I'm sure both records will do very well." I think a deal with very, very composed, very nice here. Ozzy retorts, "Dissers, I object to being objected to." No, he doesn't say that. That's an old Monty Python sketch, but this shit does kind of read like a Python sketch back and forth. Ozzy says, "Sabbath is dead now. It's not that I don't like what they are doing. It's great music, what they are doing." Okay, so there's a bunch of claims that he says he never has heard of Heaven and Hell, even to present day. So, but anyway, "it's not Black Sabbath," he says. "It's a new band. It's a different band. It doesn't even remotely sound like Sabbath, apart from Tony Iommi's thundering riffs. It wasn't until I'd left that I realized how much of a part of Sabbath I was, you know? It's not like losing a bass player or a drummer." Shots fired to Nibby and Geezer, too, here. Then Dio says, I feel like I'm in a high school, Mean Girls. Then Christy said, "Oh my God, has anyone seen Nibby? Is he okay?" Dio says, "Well, I think he's right. I think he's right. In that he's talking about there is no more Black Sabbath with Ozzy Osbourne in it. He's absolutely right. It's not even remotely close as far as I'm concerned. I think you will find the riffs Tony is playing are probably the most musical riffs. And the reason probably being that he has someone who can compare musically to the riffs he is playing. I'll make a derogatory statement for you and you can play it to Ozzy if you like." Okay, so Dio's got some venom here. He's talking from the context of when he was in Black Sabbath. Granted, a bass player or a drummer leaving a band would not make much of an impression as a vocalist or guitar player. He's right about the drummer. This band is not the band that did Iron Man or War Pigs because I don't sound like Ozzy. At least I hope I don't sound like Ozzy. Whew. I don't try to. I don't want to. This is a band that has progressed where Ozzy either refused to progress or was incapable of progression. I'd like to think he was incapable. I can tell you things that the other people in this band won't tell you. I've seen things in Cream Magazine and Rolling Stone that Ozzy has said about Geezer and myself in particular. To reply to those things Ozzy has said is like dueling with an unarmed man. I feel like someone who has a sword up against someone who has no clue what a weapon is. He's getting medieval on his ass here. I find the man to be stupid, totally devoid of intelligence, an animal. I can give you examples to back up what I am saying. I would not say them if I didn't firmly believe them. I doubt very much Ozzy could carry a tune if you gave him a radio in a suitcase and gave it to him in his hand. Remember, this is what people who worked with him for 12 years should be saying, and I'm saying it for them. It's about time someone replied to the idiocies this man has been saying. And we don't bite the heads off of birds. We don't spit blood at people. We don't need to. We wish Ozzy success. Okay, so boom, I give the KO to little Ronnie there. There was no retort from Ozzy, at least in this article. Closing the book like a boss. And that kind of does sound like Dio there, especially the sword reference. And if we want to go in support of my theory that this is all made up shit, stuff is kind of scripted, maybe they just didn't let RJD in on it. I don't know, you guys tell me. And Ozzy comes off as a total ass clown there in the excerpts, which I get people might think that's what he was, right? But I don't know, it just seems a little staged to me. Like he's being directed to stir the shit here, and we all know who's probably doing that. But all right, I'll do my head in trying to figure out this fucking strategy here. Too much he said, she said, and ultimately, the guys do bury the hatchet. We never speak of this again once they, you know, reunite later on. Not to spoil anything, but it happens. Add to this drama here, there was talk that Ronnie was planning to do a solo album as well. And I think the idea of that, even if he was going to do the solo album and still be in Sabbath, it didn't sit well with Geezer and Tony. So even before the release of Live Evil, this is when the infighting started. There might be more conspiracy theories to be had in here, but I'll ignore them. But to cut through the bullshit again, from the book Symptom of the Universe by Mick Wall, which is a great fucking book. If you haven't taken my recommendation and picked this one up, go get it. I would love to get Mick Wall actually on the show. He's one of the few people that I'd let him talk because I'm not much of an interviewer, but I would love to hear his side of the drama here because he was actually with Kerrang at the time, I believe, so he would have definitely known where the bodies are buried and have an inside track on this. But he does a great job covering it here in his book anyway. So this is the first downfall of this Dio Sabbath. I'll just read it out here, but still go buy the book, Mick Wall, Symptom of the Universe. So he writes, they would argue about it in public for years to come, how Dio and Appice snuck into the studio at night after Iommi and Butler had gone home and began fiddling with the mix, bringing Ronnie's vocals and Vinny's drums further up into the mix and pushing Tony's guitar and Geezer's bass down, how it led to a final falling out, which then caused Ronnie and Vinny to walk away. Or the other one, how Tony fired Ronnie for trying to take over the band, how he'd always wanted Vinny to stay, but that Ronnie had worked his spell on the younger man, forcing him to follow the singer back out into the street. Yet none of this was true, or very little. And even the parts that were, arguments over the mix of the Live Evil album, were really just the last skirmishes in a growing war that was about to split Black Sabbath into atoms anyway. Geezer was already bent out of shape over Ronnie's increasing influence in the band's affairs. Not just that he'd been supplanted as the band's lyricist, but how Ronnie appeared to be running the offstage business of Black Sabbath as well, which in the absence of a true manager or any strong figure in the band taking keen interest was of course true. We just saw it, and he was trying to take over the band, said Geezer more than a quarter of a century later, and we didn't like that. Speaking now, Vinnie Appice recalls how the relationship between Tony and Ronnie and Geezer and Ronnie were starting to go downhill long before they got into the studio to mix the live Evil tapes. Tony and Geezer had no problems with me. It was just Ronnie. What he describes as a clash of a lot of egos. By the end of Mob Rules World Tour, there had been fights backstage with Tony and Ronnie screaming at each other. He adds, by the end of the tour, you could feel the vibe between them. Tony and Geezer would get into one car, and Ronnie would get into another, and I tried to keep it going by getting in all the different cars. As for Tony's later accusation that Ronnie was sneaking into the studio behind his back to alter the mix of the live album, something he says he discovered after the engineer, Lee DiCarlo, eventually broke down and told him, it runs counter to the fact that Ronnie was very much a daytime person and would have found it all but impossible to wait for Tony and Geezer to go home before sneaking into the studio, as the others rarely finished before dawn. Yeah, this is all interesting stuff. I mean, I can provide my commentary, but I think I'm just reading this part. Nobody says it better than Mick Waller. He gets the quotes anyway from all the lads. He goes on here. In fact, as Vinnie Appice explains, what happened was they booked the studio for 2 o'clock, but Tony and Geezer wouldn't get there until 4 or 5 o'clock, and this was an expensive studio. Me and Ronnie would be there at 2. Ronnie wanted to do some work, so he would start doing whatever needed to be done, and then they took that as Ronnie sneaking into the studio and doing stuff behind their back. Anyway, this all kind of goes the way it does. And I mean, cocaine probably fueled some of this as well. And this Leo DiCarlo character kind of planting some conspiracy theories of his own, it seems. But anyway, it creates a bitter end for something that was so fucking powerful on stage in Wax. Dio Sabbath breaks up because of this live Evil drama. And yeah, that's pretty much it for today. That's where we'll pick up next time, I guess. But hey, we got 2 tremendous platters to open this decade. So let's celebrate that fact instead of dwelling on this nasty breakup. I enjoyed the fuck out of both of them. And Live Evil is a cool piece too, despite the drama it cost. I still need to kind of go through some of the other live captures that are out there around this era. Check out if there's anything that's of the quality of like the Black and Blue film. Because I'm fucking in, guys. I want to see this Mob Rules in action. I fell in love with the country girl. And now I'm into Dio. Wow. Who'd have thunk it? I can love both Dio and Ozzy. You don't have to take sides here, folks. That's what they want you to do. And it's far from over, lads. We'll reopen the Dio Sabbath Bible soon enough. And we'll see how they fare in the 1990s. And then in the 2000 whatevers. But that's it for 80s Dio Sabbath. However, I've certainly rambled on and read out loud enough for the day here. Hope you enjoyed it. As always, get in touch with me on the Twitter at Sabbath Bloody Podcast and keep sending me emails because I love hearing from you people, all you supernauts all over the world. I get like 2 or 3 a month. That's pretty awesome. And the rest of you who are just silently worshiping the Sabbath with me here, that's cool too. I appreciate you listening in. So keep on and on and on and on, my friends. And bog blast, all ya. Yeah.